Welcome to the Background Briefing podcast. This week, death in the line of duty. Like soldiers returning from combat, police officers around Australia are battling the symptoms of post-traumatic stress after years of frontline work. They're shunned, isolated, traumatised, and in extreme cases, they take their own lives. It's an epidemic that's remained hidden until now. But the dramatic final words of one officer and a push for a parliamentary inquiry may yet end the silence. It's Minion Falls in northern New South Wales, on the evening of Monday, December the 16th, 2013. A picturesque spot, popular with tourists and families for bush picnics, where the waters of Repentance Creek plunge onto rocks at the base of a 100-metre cliff. Former police detective Ashley Bryant is sitting in his car. He takes out his phone and calls 000.
Police emergency, this is Dominique.
Okay, can I speak to the supervisor on the ex-detective sergeant of police?
Okay. Do you need to speak to the local police station?
No, I want your supervisor, please, if you don't mind.
So just so you understand, 000 is an emergency call centre?
I understand that. It's been recorded and that's exactly what I want.
Okay. What was your name?
Ashley Bryant.
Ashley, I can't transfer you to a supervisor because there's no need to. Okay.
All right. Well, I'm about to take my life.
Well, where are you?
I'm at Minion Falls, M-I-N-Y-O-N.
Yep.
Falls.
Yep. Where is that? What town is that in?
That is Lismore Patrol.
In Lismore. And why, mate? What's happened to make you cause you to do that?
I understand this is being recorded and I suffer post-traumatic stress disorder. I can no longer live with the trauma of it.
Okay.
And I want this to go to the coroner.
Right.
There needs to be more things put in place for what for the partners of those that suffer, because I suffer.
Yep.
And so do the partners, and there has to be more done for them.
Okay.
All right, I have no more to say.
Could I just ask something, Ashley? Sorry, your last name, so I know.
Is Bryant, B-R-Y-A-N-T.
Yep.
At a previous registered number of 25603.
And how old are you? Or what's your date of birth?
I'm born June 3rd.
Yep.
1969.
June the 3rd of 1969.
44 years of age.
Okay, and so you're at Minion Falls. And, mate, are you able to wait for police to get there?
No, I'll be gone before they arrive. Thank you.
Can you please at least...
Within minutes, Ashley Bryant ends his life. Since December 2012, when the last officer was killed in the line of duty in New South Wales, at least five serving or former police have taken their own lives in that state alone. Yet despite the fact that their deaths were caused by years of traumatic police work, you won't find their names on a police honour board. There's a hidden epidemic that police forces won't discuss. Now, many of those affected are arguing that the time for silence is over. Hello, I'm William Verity. This week on Background Briefing, how post-traumatic stress disorder, commonly known as PTSD, affects our police and their families, and why too many continue to pay the ultimate sacrifice. Why do you think he made that 000 call?
I think that he made the call because he wanted to bring attention to people such as himself who were in exactly the same situation, and that there needed to be a change there to give them more support to deal with not only the post-traumatic stress but to deal with the entire loss of identity and the ripple effect that has on everyone around them.
Since her husband's death, Deborah Bryant has been struggling to earn a living and raise their three young children. What did the job mean to him?
The job meant everything to him. He liked the fact that he was able to make a difference. And because he had a strong sense of right and wrong, he liked that he had the power to make things right for victims.
And what did the job mean for you?
I was proud of him, that he had the courage to do something that I would not be able to.
When Ashley Bryant finally left the force on sick leave in late 2011, it was after almost 25 years of self-medicating the trauma of his daily work. Whether it was dealing with the death of two colleagues, failing to resuscitate a young girl after a road accident, or finding a father stabbed on the streets of Sydney, every job took its toll.
He really struggled, like he was in two worlds. And he so much wanted to keep those two worlds separate, but unfortunately his work blended in with his private life, and his inability to cope with his work blended with his private life. And what was social drinking on the weekend became everyday drinking, and not in small quantities. So his alcohol intake would cycle depending on the stresses that he had at work. It would get to a point where he was drinking, you know, excessively every single night of the week with no break. And then he would realise that that was not healthy for himself and not healthy for his family, and so he would just stop. And then he would go back to fitness, and he would paddle his surf ski, and he would be running and so forth. And then he would have another stressor occur at work, and then he would cycle straight back into that drinking.
And through it all, and despite the well-documented effects of post-traumatic stress disorder, Ashley Bryant never received the help he needed. This is in stark contrast to claims made by the New South Wales Police Force about the help it provides.
Whilst they're with us, many intervention programs that we will go through with the officer to make sure those services are given to them urgently and immediately. Very much supported by in their workplace by their commanders and fellow officers. We have psychologists on contract, we have external service providers, and we will step in as soon as possible.
Assistant Commissioner Carlene York is the head of human resources for the New South Wales Police Force.
We also provide free assistance to their family members. This is for the attempted suicide, obviously, or PTSD, where they can come with the officer and talk to a psychologist or come on their own for a psychologist. So we put a lot of services in place. And we very much rally around the family in the regretful circumstances that there is a suicide, and make sure that we can assist them through those difficult times.
We'll hear more from the Assistant Commissioner later.
So what support did you receive as a family over the years from the police?
None. I don't think that we even were a glitch on their radar.
And how does that make you feel?
I'm not surprised by it, but I'm disappointed by it. I think that if they truly cared, then they wouldn't just wipe their hands of it.
Why wouldn't they truly care?
Because it's too hard. Because they're all too busy doing their own job, that they actually don't have any time or resources to do what it takes to give people the support that they need.
Deborah Bryant. Ashley Bryant's post-traumatic stress is repeated not once, not twice, but hundreds of times across Australia every year. In New South Wales alone, which has 16,000 serving police, almost one officer every day can no longer work and puts in a claim for mental stress. But that, as we shall discover, is far from the end of their struggle. For many, it's the start of a nightmare that leads them to the brink.
This is the spot I came to after, at one of my lowest points here, overlooking Bronny Beach. And it was late last year after I'd received, after 22-year legal battle and a meeting with the police minister's office, I received a letter of decline. Then I came here and I remember I lit a cigarette. I was just standing here looking at the surf to relax me. And then I thought I should just go down and walk in, out into the surf and not come back. That was crossing my mind until a little voice said to me, no, you've got your kids and your wife to worry about, your family. So, and then it was that point I just snapped out of it and got back in the car and went home.
So that was one of the lowest points. That was 22 years after leaving the police.
And, a 9-year court case. And then from here, I went straight to the psychiatrist. From here, about 12 p.m, I spent an hour with him, and he doubled my medication that day to 200 milligrams of Zoloft a day. And he said I'll be on that for the rest of my life. It may need to be increased in the future too.
It was just constant nightmares and seeing visions of deceased that I'd, you know, had to investigate, but they weren't nightmares anymore, they were becoming daymares. You know, I'd be patting the cat and I'd all of a sudden the face of a murder victim was jumping up in my face, and it was like I couldn't even walk out and hang the washing on the line without seeing a dead body on the lawn that wasn't there.
The head banging was so bad that it's pushed the bed head nuts and bolts through the wall. And then when he couldn't get any sleep and any rest, when he would be awake, he would go into the study and sleep in the study, and the paint is actually removed from where the bedhead was. And it was so bad, it would wake the person in the next room. Like, you couldn't sleep. He couldn't sleep, but he kind of, if it makes any sense, he kind of was asleep when he was having these nightmares. But he was heavily medicated, heavily medicated. You know, I say, enough to make Farlap sleep.
Post-traumatic stress disorder is defined as an anxiety disorder that occurs after single or repeated traumatic events. Its symptoms include nightmares, flashbacks, high anxiety, drug and alcohol abuse, an inability to socialise, paranoia, and a state of hyper-arousal that can leave a sufferer struggling to maintain a hold on sanity.
It's the sadness, it's an intolerable sadness. And you see it in people's eyes, they're sad. And by the time they've got as sad as they can be, their wiring's all based on anxiety.
Roger Peters is a psychologist. He's been treating police for PTSD for as long as the condition has been officially recognised, since the early 80s.
Now, cops are classic because they're taught to suppress two parts of the natural human response, which is to freeze or run away, the flight response, and they get stuck in a fight. That's why so many, almost 90% of them, have explosive anger. The people you will meet are angry to start with. The system just makes them bloody angrier.
He's never seen accurate suicide figures for Australian police, but he's in no doubt about the price they pay.
They either commit suicide literally, and few of those do that, or they do it psychologically, with drugs, alcohol, or misuse of their own medication.
Roger Peters is scathing about the system that offers them no dignified exit, arguing that once officers have PTSD, they can never do police work again. He says officers are punished for being injured, and that the system needs a major overhaul. He recommends police spend no more than 20 years on the front line.
I would make the same recommendation that I made 30 years ago, and they have 20-year pensions, and they give people something to run towards and then give them some dignity on exit. I would not let people stay in the job for as long as they do at the general service level, because it's just debilitating.
It's a point that's underlined by Professor Sandy McFarlane, a world expert on PTSD from the University of Adelaide.
I think the first thing you've got to do is to have an occupational health approach, which involves anticipating the hazard and thinking about how you're going to manage exposure. If you're working in a lead smelter, you regularly screen the lead level of the employees, and if they become over that level, you take them out of the smelter until such time as that lead level has gone down again. And I think policing is very similar. The issue is that if people are beginning to accumulate symptoms, and particularly if that rate of symptom accumulation is increasing quickly, you've got to have other roles in the police force where you rotate them.
Professor McFarlane draws the comparison between police at work and soldiers in combat.
Now, I think the exposures the police get in many of their roles, like SWAT teams or forensic service groups or even some general duties officers, are like being constantly in a war zone. We don't expect our soldiers to do this, so we shouldn't expect our police to do it.
I'm visiting the place where many Sydney officers end up for treatment. Senior psychologist Kevin Fennell is showing me around.
So this is our relatively new facility. It's an outpatients department of the St John of God Healthcare Hospital at Burwood. And here we have the new reception area where people come in and are allocated to groups or allocated to group rooms and made to feel at home and welcomed into the facility. As we go down here, there are some doctors' consulting rooms.
In the art therapy room, we meet psychologist Emily Owen.
And what I'm looking at in front of me right now is a collage that was done by one of our police officers whose job it was to defuse bombs in the police. And she's done a collage which was part of our group process to get at sort of starting to make sense of some of these traumatic experiences that haunt people. And the collage that I'm looking at is of a number of images that she's chosen, one of which is a diver in a deep sea, old fashioned style diving suit, suspended under the water. And she's chosen that image to talk about the sense of you put your life on the line for this job, and yet when something goes wrong, there's that feeling of being cut adrift, of being underwater, of being disconnected and disengaged from life, but also being inherently vulnerable at this point and unable to reach out to supports or feel supported by police, by insurance companies. That is indeed their perception.
This is a place of hope, a place that shows officers, often referred through the police force, that they're not alone.
Of course, in our program, the protectiveness of meeting with other peers who have something similar really helps to counter the sense of isolation and desperation and this experience of feeling that they're going crazy. They don't understand why they are so haunted by these images, so haunted by this sense that they're weak or broken for having this experience of trauma. Very pleased to say we've never had any of our police officers commit suicide.
Isolation aggravates the symptoms of PTSD, says Emily Owen.
And the stigma around having PTSD and being perceived as somehow weak or broken or that they are being a shonk to the system, these are the kind of internal messages that prevent people from seeking help early enough. And that's what we want to counter. That's what we want to change the culture, both in the police and in the wider society, to accept this is a very difficult job. We're very lucky to have people doing it, and we need to look after those people.
The symptoms of post-traumatic stress often build up over years. Early intervention is crucial. Kimberly Galvin lives at the outer edge of Sydney, at the foot of the Blue Mountains. In her living room, she's showing me two contrasting photos of her husband, Tom. One from when he joined the police in 1987, and another a couple of years before he took his own life, on July the 16th last year. So just explain to me what you're doing now and what you're showing.
Okay. This is a very young picture of Tom, a picture in the very early days of him graduating from the academy and entering the police force.
So what I'm looking at here is obviously a card from the funeral. Yeah. Thomas Patrick Galvin, 23rd of the 5th, 1966, to the 16th of the 7th, 2013. Just describe to me that photo for me.
So for me, this photo is alive. You know, you can see sparkle in Tom's eyes, you can see happy face, you can see he's unaffected, there's no trauma, he's really excited and alive. And this photo is a picture of us taken probably 2 years before Tom's passing. And if you look close in, the sparkle is gone. There's no expression. It's a mask. It doesn't look like Tom. The sadness in Tom's eyes and it's blank. You're looking and, you know, that was a happy day for us. That was Stephanie's birthday. It was an exciting day. It was a happy day. But it's just, he's blank. Mm. There's nothing there. There was nothing left to give.
As with many who suffer from PTSD, there was one job that finally broke him.
There was one incident, and I've actually learned more about this incident through Tom's nightmares, through reliving that incident, than what he'd ever kind of discussed. But there was one incident, and it was the final straw.
It was the suicide of a young man, the 19th suicide Tom Galvin investigated in a few months. And that was after his own father had killed himself. Months later, Kimberly Galvin found her husband had slept with operational papers relating to that final job on the night before he died. Tom Galvin was a popular officer and had 600 mourners and a police guard of honour at his funeral. Yet fewer than half a dozen of those had contacted him while he was sick for 6 years. none of his colleagues have contacted Kimberley since the funeral. It's been said that for many police colleagues, PTSD feels like a contagious disease, and they need to protect their own mental health. As with many suicides, the coroner spares the family by withholding findings. It's as if the suicide never happened. And that denial was never more apparent than at last year's Police Day of Remembrance.
Police Day of Remembrance was a very difficult day for me. It's something that I probably still and maybe will never come to terms with, because it came in the same police remembrance year as an officer killed on duty. With all due respect, it was like no one else had died that year. It was very difficult for me to kind of come to terms with a position of, you know, your husband goes to work and he doesn't come back, as opposed to your husband who's suffering and suffering and suffering and suffering and ends his life, that those two things, you know, are acknowledged in such different ways, or one is acknowledged extensively and one is not acknowledged at all.
At the Remembrance Day, Kimberley Galvin witnessed a scene that for her said it all.
There was a parade and you could see that the police were very young and there were lots of them, and it was a very hot day. It was a hot, really hot morning. And one of them collapsed from the heat and he was just moved out and the line was moved up. And I remember watching it and thinking, that's how this operates. When you can't do what you're supposed to do, you're just out and move up and someone else fills that spot and you're just out.
Nearly one officer a day in New South Wales collapses from mental stress and makes a claim for compensation. One of those was former Detective Carol Blackley, who now runs a Facebook page for injured officers. After 22 years in the police, she knows what it's like to slip off the edge, or in police jargon, to fall off the perch. She was ducks of her class and has had a distinguished career.
We're in the formal room of where I live, the house. In my display cabinet here, I have a few things that I received from the police during my 22-year career. So I've got my prep medallion when I become Ducks of the Class 247. A pin from the senior detective's course, which I used to wear on my detective suit. And
like many officers, Carol Blackley stayed too long because she loved her job.
So I've got my 10-year medal there as well, and a sergeant's commission certificate, which I received after having to chase it up 5 years myself.
And what isn't there?
Well, what's not there is my 15-year clasp, my 20-year clasp. I haven't got a certificate or statement of service signed by the commissioner, as you formally get when you are discharged. So those things would mean a lot to me if I did get them in the end.
And why aren't they there?
Because nobody's acknowledged that I've left.
Carol's career ended after attending one job too many. It was nothing out of the ordinary, an overdose in a drug squat.
I became hysterical. I became quite withdrawn. I'd use the word very aggressive, very irritable, very antisocial. I attempted to hang myself. Fortunately, my partner was in the house at the time and freaked out. So I pretty much left. I drove the car to the hotel. I drank as much alcohol as I could. I rang everyone in my phone book and said goodbye. And then I drove the car in an attempt to try and hit into a lamppost or whatever.
This was after trying to hang yourself.
That's correct. Somehow I pulled over, slept it off and didn't kill myself and didn't kill anyone else, which was more important. But I was in such a state that I didn't care. I just wanted the nightmare to end.
Since that day, Carol Blackley has had little meaningful contact with the police force. A senior officer rings her once a month in order to report to a management meeting. The safety command referred her to a counsellor and then shunted her through 5 different caseworkers, sometimes informing her by email. And none of her colleagues have been in touch.
My whole career is gone. It was going to be a life career for me. I didn't study and become Ducks of the Class because it was going to be just a casual thing that I was doing in my spare time. It was my life.
having been forgotten about is upsetting. It's disappointing, and it makes you very confused about how you feel about the police and the time that you sacrificed. I wonder why I bothered.
Former Detective Carol Blackley. You're listening to Background Briefing. This week, investigating the connection between post-traumatic stress and suicide amongst police officers. I'm William Verity. Strange though it may seem, there are worse things than being ignored if you're an officer with PTSD. For those who are on sick leave and waiting for a payout, it's the treatment meted out by their insurance company that adds a whole new level of torture to their situation. Take Andy Peveril. He's one of a group of officers in New South Wales who call themselves the Forgotten 300. They're too sick to return to work, but they're made to fight for a payout from their insurance company, in this case MetLife. He's too traumatised to take a phone call, so his wife, Michelle, tells his story from an undisclosed location to escape surveillance.
We're hiding at the moment. He has a so-called independent medical examination with MetLife coming up, and we know from previous experience what they do is they film prior to the examination and then they show that to the psychiatrist and say, well, does that marry up with the man that you've seen? So I've just taken him out the back of Woodwork so that he can actually get, well, a bit of peace so he can just sit and read and, yeah, without the fear of being filmed.
Michelle Peveril runs a chicken business from the couple's farm near Parkes in western New South Wales.
Nobody knows where we've gone, what we've done. I've left strict instructions for my staff. They don't know where we've gone, but they've not to talk to anybody. And I've already had a phone call this morning from somebody who arrived at the property asking my staff if they wanted to buy chickens and where was I. And then he then phoned me to say, oh, where are you? I want to buy some chooks, which we don't sell chooks, so that's really unusual. We just sneak out late at night because we know that once they think that we've finished, the lights go off or we go to bed, they actually stop filming. Not that there's anything to film, but it means that you're just, yeah, you've got the blinds down all day because you won't have the blinds up and all of that sort of thing.
Like others of the Forgotten 300, the Peverils first get to see the surveillance footage when the insurance company mails it to their doctor or lawyer.
They follow, just for example, my husband for a case of about 18 days. And then, yeah, you just get the footage. And they argue, well, look, he can go for a walk in the paddock. He can, you know, be with you. That means he's able to work. They filmed our scarecrow in our paddock for 20 minutes and said it was him. And it was a scarecrow, which is, like, unbelievable. They filmed me at a farmer's market. I own my own business. And Andy standing next to me. And lots of irrelevant things. Lots and lots of shots of our house, empty, nobody there. Lots of shots of my grandchildren. More footage of myself and my grandchildren than of actually Andy.
Michelle Peveril believes the insurance company will eventually refuse her husband's claim, and they'll have to start the whole process again through the courts. More than half of those who make a claim end up giving up. And in what is now becoming a familiar story, Michelle details the support received from the New South Wales Police Force.
None from the New South Wales Police Force, none whatsoever. In fact, when they medically discharged him, they phoned his mobile and he was having a heart attack. And I said, you cannot speak to him. He's right at the moment. He's in intensive care. And they said, well, just tell him he's been medically discharged, will you? And that was the last time any type of contact from the New South Wales Police Force.
It's the New South Wales Police Force who gave the contract to MetLife and who have since written to complain about delays. Assistant Commissioner Carlene York.
Well, we've communicated with them probably over the last 9 months as discussions have continued on.
And have you seen any results from that yet?
No, I'm aware that there's still some decisions outstanding, but we are disappointed at the delays by MetLife, and we have written to them and asked them to bring the outstanding cases to a close and make a decision. It's a matter for them what decision it is, but we know the stress that that can cause on the officers when the matters are still outstanding.
The state's police minister, Michael Gallagher, himself a former police officer, issued a one-line statement to Background Briefing directing any complaints about insurance to the New South Wales Police Force. The New South Wales Police Force say they are powerless to act on the issue. Background Briefing also contacted MetLife for comment but received no reply. Trauma expert Sandy McFarlane says there may be some officers who fake their claim.
The point of malingering is always an important one. You've always got to have your system attuned to the possibility that there's going to be a group of people who do misrepresent their symptoms and misrepresent their story. But the point is, that is always going to be a minority. And the thing is, you don't treat the genuine cases as though they're malingerers, because that really just often adds to these people's morbidity and distress. And I think it's a very easy narrative to sell. And I think the prejudice against psychiatric illness really, in some ways, feeds the acceptance of that approach.
Professor McFarlane is also highly critical of the surveillance employed by insurance companies.
It's like torturing them, really. I mean, it's really bringing back the whole circumstance by which they become unwell. And you've got to remember, look, there are always going to be crook cops and there are always going to be malingerers. But if you've been somebody who's been out there prosecuting criminals and you've become unwell in the course of doing it, and then you get treated like a criminal and being treated with considerable suspicion for every claim you make, I mean, it just constantly then is a moral affront.
Yet there may be some hope for the hundreds of sick police living in limbo. This week, New South Wales Greens MP David Shoebridge is hoping to announce a parliamentary inquiry into the insurance issue. Before he entered Parliament, he was a barrister and represented sick police.
Well, if you wanted to see a sort of case study in how obtuse and quite brutal the police can be, I remember acting for one woman who had been an undercover police officer for more than a decade. And undercover policing is extremely stressful. You're often putting yourself in life-threatening situations, going undercover, making friendships with drug dealers and bikies and violent criminals, often having to get a close friendship with them. And then you effectively, on one level, betray them in court when you give Crown evidence, or they expose themselves to extremely dangerous situations where people armed to the teeth are doing drug deals. And this woman had been doing this kind of work for over a decade and eventually decompensated and went off work on post-traumatic stress. And the police defended the case, alleging that her post-traumatic stress was not due to her enormously traumatic undercover work, but was due to the fact that she'd had twins.
For David Shoebridge, the case is symptomatic of how officers are treated by the force once they get a psychological injury.
From day one, when a police officer reports with a psychiatric illness, they say that they're suffering significant stress or gone off on PTSD, they effectively get a big red mark put on them. Then when they do, if they do eventually get hurt on duty and have their injury accepted and found they can't work, they go from what is a very close collegiate grouping in the New South Wales Police to being completely frozen out. And I mean absolutely frozen out by the police force.
Background Briefing sought an interview with the police union, the New South Wales Police Association, but they declined, saying it was their policy not to comment on suicide. None of the officers contacted by this program said they'd received any support of any kind from their union. David Shoebridge does not agree that silence is the best way to protect police.
The police service owes it to police to actually get a proper handle on the numbers, to actually ensure that they're following through and seeing how many police, once they cease service, end up taking their life, and looking to see whether or not that's caused by their work. And they're not doing that. And for me, that's a big, big hole in the necessary protection and the necessary recognition that there needs to be for serving police.
Background Briefing put the question of suicide numbers to the officer in charge of human resources for the New South Wales Police, Assistant Commissioner Carlene York. What kind of figures do you have on the suicide of police, particularly over time?
We don't give out the figures in relation to suicide. It's a matter where it is particularly stressful for us, where it culminates in suicide or attempted suicide.
Do those figures exist for the numbers of police who kill themselves?
They certainly would exist for the current members, but we don't always hear about when they happen out. Once they've exited the organisation, we hear of some. But there's no way in which we can keep the figures. But, you know, often the family will come forward to us, or we hear because we provide support services post the suicide.
So you have figures for those serving police who take their own lives?
We would have those figures, yes.
Yes. Can you tell me what they are?
I don't know what they are off the top of my head.
Can you tell me how they've changed, if at all, over time?
No, I do. Look, I do know from some of my studies that, you know, I've been to America and done a couple of courses with the American police, and similarly over there it is disturbing for the number of suicides. And I know they did some research studies some years ago that showed police suicides were at a higher level than what it was from the hands of offenders, which is concerning.
How is it possible to test the efficiency or the efficacy of your support services if you don't know the result?
We do know the result in that we don't know the numbers, but we know that it actually happened. So we make sure that we try and put all these programs into place that it doesn't happen. Mm. But
if you're putting programs into place and for instance, the number of suicides going up, then clearly the programs aren't working.
Well, I don't see that you can conclude that. As I said before, we're putting a lot of emphasis now on the prevention and the resilience programs and the support that we have, and we know that they're successful.
Whether those programs are successful or not, and without reliable and public data over time, we'll never know. It's clear that police forces around Australia have a long way to go until they can claim to have done enough for traumatised officers and their families. For the families of those who have taken their own lives, a first step would be to include their names on police honour boards. Here's Detective Sergeant Ashley Bryant's widow, Deborah Bryant. How has life been for you since December the 16th?
It's been incredibly hard. It's been a huge mixture of emotions. I'm so incredibly sad for Ashley that he felt that it was better to sacrifice himself so that his family didn't have to deal with his hurt and his anger.
Thank you. Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Yes, there is.
Yeah.
I think that it's a disgrace that the police service don't count these guys on their honour board. They're discharged hurt on duty. Sorry, I'll say that again. They're discharged hurt on duty with a recognised illness that's directly related to their police service. And the link between post-traumatic stress and depression and suicide is well recognised. So why aren't these police on the police honour board?
What difference would recognition make to you?
It's not recognition for me. I think it's recognition for the police who are still there, that they are important and that they're doing an important job. And when they get to, if they get to the point where they're not coping with that anymore, that they're not pushed aside and forgotten. And I think that that is what it's all about, because these people have given their life for their career and they've gotten to the point where they're broken, and they should be recognised for that, because as far as I'm concerned, that's death in the line of duty.
If you or someone you know is experiencing a crisis, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. The Lifeline number again, 13 11 14. Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research by Anna Whitfeld. Technical production by Mark Don. The executive producer is Chris Bullock. And I'm William Verity.